You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Kushan Avidar, in for Allison Stewart. We've been speaking with author James L. Swanson about the Apple TV Plus adaptation of his best-selling book, Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer. And now we'll discuss James's latest foray into American history. 320 years ago, the colonial community of Deerfield, Massachusetts, was attacked by combined French and indigenous forces. Many men, women, and children were killed. 112 colonists were taken captive and marched 300 miles to Canada in February. Many died along the way. Known as the Deerfield Massacre, this event became a flashpoint in the already poor relationship between Indigenous Americans and colonists. As colonists believed innocents had been brutally attacked, while many Indigenous communities saw this as retribution for years of violent occupation by outsiders. James chronicles the violence and delves into the historical importance of this event in his new book, The Deerfield Massacre, A Surprise Attack, A Forced March, and the Fight for Survival in Early America. And James, thanks for sticking around with us.
My pleasure.
So you note that the word massacre was not used to describe these events until the 100th anniversary of the attack, so a century later. Why do you think that is, and why did you decide to use it in this book?
Well, I use the word massacre because that's how it's been popularly known for a few hundred years. Yes, the people who survived it never called it a massacre. They called it the raid, the attack, the sacking. They even called it the mischief in Deerfield. It was not until 1804 when the town's minister called it a massacre repeatedly. It became transformed in popular consciousness because of the colonial revival. There was a historian in Deerfield named George Sheldon who wrote a massive history of the town, and he was really the official memory keeper and myth maker of Deerfield. He wanted to erase the role of natives and native tribes in the attack. The French were accompanied by their allies, Hurons, Mohawks, Penacooks, Abnakis, the Iroquois of the mountain. And so individual tribes had different motives for participating in this attack. The overall scheme was that England and France were fighting over control of the North American continent, and each side had its own native allies. And so as the 19th century moved forward into the 1870s, 1880s, George Sheldon and others were celebrating their colonial forebears as a superior civilization that had conquered the savage tribes, as they thought. And so they, in the safety and comfort of memory, decided that it was a massacre, and the Indians were savages. And if you go to a museum in town, the Pocumptuck Valley Memorial Association in Deerfield, which was founded by George Sheldon, there were massive racist tropes carved into the walls. There's a chamber there filled with memorial cenotaphs. It looks like a mausoleum. For example, one tablet memorializes a little girl who was 2 years old and said, captured by the natives in a savage raid. And she became a savage and married one. Later, that was corrected over time.
Oh, I think that we have James frozen there. We're going to see if we can get James back up. This is All of It.
I'm here.
Oh, hey, James. Hey, welcome back. Sorry, you just froze for a second. The last thing that we heard was talking about that tablet and how it was fixed in the future. So you want to pick up from there?
Yes, sure. The tablet says the little girl became a savage and married one. Well, for the 300th anniversary, that museum created fabric coverings to put over those to describe in a more realistic way, the truth of what really happened. So to describe the name she took as a native, who she married, how she lived with the tribe and had children there. And the same was true of Eunice Williams, the 7-year-old daughter of Reverend John Williams, who's one of the major characters in the story. She was captured as a 7-year-old girl. She was captured by Mohawks, raised as a Mohawk, because sometimes during the raids, the tribes wanted to conduct what they called mourning wars, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. The purpose of those raids was to capture young boys and girls and incorporate them into equal members of the native tribes. They wanted to place people who had been killed in battle or died or make enlarge the power in numbers of the tribe. And so she was taken and never came home. Williams lived another 25 years after his capture, after his return from Deerfield. And to his dying day, he was burdened by the memory of his little girl. Two of his children had been killed during the raid, a six-week-old girl and a young boy, and they were murdered in front of him. And so his wife was killed during the first day of the march, killed by tomahawk. And so Williams wanted so much to have his little girl come home, but she never came back. She remained in the tribe, and she was one of probably the last survivor of the Deerfield Massacre.
Wow.
She died at a very old age.
You know, it's interesting to hear you bring up these stories that you can go into a museum and look at for yourself, but they are narratives that have been developing, and people get to kind of choose what frame of that narrative to take. And listeners are probably wondering what accounts for the attack were the main sources for your book, and how can you trust those accounts given that, of course, each side would be coming at things from their own agenda? How did you navigate all that?
Well, partly, one of the main sources is a book written by Reverend Williams. After his triumphant return to Boston and his freedom, he wrote a book called The Redeemed Captive, Return to Zion. He was an important Puritan leader, the first one captured by the French and the Jesuits there and by the natives. And his book is partly an action thriller, which describes quite accurately how the attack unfolded. And then his son, Stephen Williams, wrote another account. And then there's various correspondence between French officials and in Canada, back to the main leaders in France, and English leaders also wrote about it all too. And so we know part of the main story from that. Also through the researches of George Sheldon, who saved documents, relics, materials that would otherwise have been lost. And partly we know it through oral histories of native tribes. There was not a written account of the attack by a Huron, Anunnaki, a Mohawk, an Iroquois. And so we have to search for tribal traditions. And one of the good things that's happened in Deerfield since that raid 320 years ago is that the native peoples are now coming back to Deerfield. They tell their stories. And one of the important people in this movement is a professor named Marge Bruchak. And so she brings native perspective to what happened in Deerfield. And I try to do the same, because essentially Deerfield appropriated the story from the Native Americans. In the 19th century and in modern times, their stories have been appropriated from everything from naming sports teams, products, commercial foods for sale, imagery. And from that time to John Wayne's The Searchers, where Indian captivity is a main theme, the story had been originally told from a white colonial English perspective. And it's so important now that authentic native voices are also now part of the Deerfield story. And it's become much more even-handed. Remember, the English did things like offer scalp bounties, even for Indian children, let alone men and women. Hmm. The English wanted to purchase savage dogs that would tear the Indians apart. And the terminology used by the settlers against the Indians was racist and over the top. And so it's been very important to tell the story with other voices too.
Absolutely. This is All of It from WNYC. We are talking to James L. Swanson about his book, The Deerfield Massacre, A Surprise Attack, A Forced March, and the Fight for Survival in Early America. James, we're talking about Deerfield. Let's bring it to some granular level. Can you tell us about colonial Deerfield? Where was it geographically? Why? What made it seem like such an ideal spot for settlers?
Well, Deerfield was in the northwestern part of Massachusetts, set in the Connecticut River Valley, which is an extremely fertile piece of land. It was great to grow crops, great to raise cattle and other animals. So it was ideally suited for settlers who wanted to build an English-style town based on an agricultural economy. It was not a rich town like Massachusetts and other places. Deerfield was pretty poor. It was hardy, regular people who didn't have valuable materials there, objects, treasure, nothing like that. Their hard work really built the town. And so that's what Deerfield was. It was also a terrifying time. This was 75 years before the American Revolution, long before Washington, Franklin, Adams, Jefferson had even been born. This was a remote and dangerous and terrifying early America. People were terrified of the forest. They believed in Longfellow's representation later, the forest primeval, darkness, danger, lack of civilization, savagery. The Salem witchcraft trials had happened only a few years before the Deerfield Massacre. People believed in hexes, superstitions. In fact, the great surviving relic of the massacre is an object called the Old Indian Door. That was the house of the George Sheldon House, which was attacked during the raid. The raiders could not break that door down. They chopped it multiple times with axes and tomahawks. They tried to set it on fire. They tried to use muscle to burn it, break through with a half a dozen men trying to push the door open. It never yielded. And to the colonists, that became an important symbol of the barrier between civilization and savagery. They thought it was a sign from God that they were meant to triumph. Interestingly, and you can visit that door today, it's in the PVA Museum, and you can see the tomahawk strikes. You can see a hole cut through the door where they thrust a musket barrel through that hole, fired blindly, and killed the woman inside. Deerfield is the only town I know of that celebrates its defeat because they've appropriated the whole story and turned it over the centuries into a tourist attraction, into a symbol of the triumph of the colonization of Northern America by the English settlers. It's fascinating how over time, Deerfield has meant so many different things to so many different people.
And it's super interesting to hear you talk about that idea that religion played and how, you know, there's a sign from God to do X, Y, or Z. And the Deerfield Massacre was far from the first time Deerfield experienced conflict and violence with Native American tribes in the area. So why didn't they decide that the area was too dangerous and that they should move on? Was it kind of religion, as you're suggesting, or something else?
Yes, that was part of, you know, it was religious faith, they felt. The Puritan faith was very strong. One reason why John Williams and the captives were taken to New Canada or New France in Canada is that the Jesuit priests who dominated that region were keen on converting English captives to the Catholic faith. They threatened to kill John Williams if he wouldn't convert, and he refused. They offered him bribes. He refused. They offered him freedom to him and his children ahead of the other colonists if he would just renounce the Puritan faith and convert to Catholicism. And he refused to do any of that. And it was so dangerous. In 1675, during King Philip's War, Deerfield experienced the so-called Bloody Brook Massacre. Teamsters bringing food and grain to English settlers fighting against King Philip were ambushed by 800 to 1,000 natives. During that massacre or that ambush, about 70 people were killed, and there was a great native triumph. For the next 25 years, since Bloody Brook until the time of the Deerfield Massacre in 1704, there had been dozens of raids, dozens of kidnappings in the field. And so it was a time of fear. And so people returned to Deerfield anyway after Bloody Brook in 1675, and then they were attacked again in 1704. And then many of them came back to Deerfield and started all over again, even though the danger of attack continued for the next 30 years. And it took us as a kind of person to experience that.
And it's important, I think, at this point to bring in the French as well, because it wasn't just indigenous forces involved in this attack on Deerfield. It was the French forces that they were aligned with as well. How did the tribes and the French become aligned? What was everyone's motives in the attack?
Well, the motives were varied. There were many Indian villages in New France, and the tribes allied to the French for different reasons that were important to them, whether it was to capture people and incorporate them into the tribes. Was it vengeance for the stealing of land or for old offenses that the Indians felt needed punishment or reciprocity? Some of them wanted to sell the English captives back to the English for ransom money. Or get exchanged French prisoners returned to France. And so there were multiple motives. It involved the fur trade, money, tribal rights, possession of land, because the natives had a different conception of land ownership than the white colonists did. The white colonists thought to acquire Indian land meant they owned it. They could do whatever they want to it and exclude others. The native perspective was land ownership was a shared thing. So when they did a deal with colonists for the quote sale, close quote, of a piece of land, the natives thought that meant they could come back to fish, they could come back seasonally, they could come back to hunt or even grow their own crops. Whereas the English thought that meant they were gone and they couldn't come back. So that was one source of the strife. And the French really fanned these flames because their main interest was promulgating the Catholic faith as well as they could, and fomenting a war, a series of war between France and England over control of the entire North American continent.
Mm. And many of the captives from Deerfield ended up assimilating to life among indigenous cultures, you know, learning their customs and languages and even marrying indigenous people. What do we know about why some captives decided to assimilate?
Well, imagine this, especially for the young. Imagine you're a 5 or 8-year-old boy or girl, and you're separated from your parents. In the case of Eunice Williams, her mother had been murdered, and she was separated from her father during the captivity for most of the time. So you don't have adult supervision. You're freed from the strict rules of the Puritan faith, regular church going, reading the Bible, discipline. So you're offered the option of living with native people, hunting with them, fishing with them, enjoying looser regulation of their behavior. Many young people found it liberating to be freed from the life of a strict Puritan religious village, as in Deerfield. So to many young people, it was an appealing way of life. Hmm. The children were punished. They weren't treated horribly. They were incorporated into the tribes and treated well. And so they were very susceptible to this conversion. And the first thing that happened is often they forgot how to speak English, and then they spoke native languages. They wore native clothing. They gave up their English clothing. And so in many ways, these people were treated well. And some of the older people married Frenchmen. Some of them married natives. And so it was different levels of appeal. Some people like living in Canada. They like living with the French. And so not all the captives returned or wanted to return.
Mm. And are there any success stories about any of these captives, people who actually made happy lives in their new homes?
Well, some of those stories are not easy to recover. Mm. In the 1920s, some of John Sheldon's disciples trekked to Canada themselves. They interviewed priests, researched church records, visited places where they lived. So, and some of the people just vanished from history. So we don't know the long-term fate of all of the captives. We know of some of them, quite a number of them. There were some success stories where people stayed there. They had children, they had families, they had grandchildren, and some of them have come back to visit Deerfield.
You had mentioned of the 112 captives, one of them was Reverend John Williams, and he wrote an account, as I think you had mentioned before, of his ordeal, The Redeemed Captive, which became kind of a colonial bestseller at the time. What goals do you think Williams had with this account? Was there a certain agenda he was trying to get across?
Yes, he had a few goals. One was to celebrate the bravery of the Deerfield people who had survived this massacre. He wanted to celebrate the bravery of his parishioners, his congregation. That was one goal. Two, he wanted to illustrate what he thought was the Indian cruelty, because during that march of the 112 people, 20 were killed along the way. The weak who couldn't keep up, the pregnant women, children. They were killed along the way with tomahawk strikes or war club strikes. Hmm. And so he wanted to document what his people had survived, the ordeal they had suffered. That was important to him. He also wrote the book as a religious tract to celebrate the superiority of the Puritan faith and God's favor for them over the Jesuit faith in Canada. It's hard to imagine now how important these religious conflicts were. I compare it to, for example, the 1950s and the Cold War and strife and competition between communism and democracy in the West. That's how fervent these religious disputes were in the 1700s.
And if you skip to today and we look back, individuals like you are trying to showcase and shed a light on the full narrative of this story. And of course, a crucial part of that understatement is the indigenous perspectives. What work has been done to include indigenous voices and perspectives in the history of this event? And for you specifically, what native sources were available to you?
A lot of them were oral. That was an important part of Native tradition. And acknowledging that in itself is an important thing to do. Secondly, we have to understand the true nature of warfare in early New England, how violent it was. And that's why the people who survived the Deerfield Massacre did not call it a massacre. Violent war was a matter of course on the New England frontier. It was expected. You assume the risk if you move to a place like that. So it was not entirely unexpected at all. And also this, the colonists didn't understand the nature of Indian warfare. They didn't adopt the European model of mass troops in tight formations firing volleys at each other. The natives thought that was a wasteful way of fighting a war and would lead to great casualties. Their preferred method was the so-called skulking way of war, which depended on surprise, ambush, firing from hidden positions. And so the Europeans didn't understand what the Indians were doing. The Europeans thought that was an uncivilized, ungentlemanly way of fighting. But for the natives, it was the way they had fought for hundreds of years in America. So one thing I try to do in the book is explain the difference between native and English-style warfare. The Indians weren't savages. They weren't evil monsters. They were perpetuating a style of warfare they had grown up with and been accustomed to for many years. And so the Indians thought it was cruel and unfair, partly because it was so successful against the English.
When you say oral history that served as your primary sources, were you talking to people? Were you listening to recordings? What was that like?
Well, also interviewing people, talking to people, reading books by Native historians who had researched the topic deeply, and also researching the culture of the various tribes who were involved in this, whether it was the Mohawks, the Iroquois, Hurons, and Abenakis or others. And so I really tried to balance it out by involving them in the story. Remember what George Sheldon did when he was the major historian in Deerfield? He erased them from the history he was writing. He also erased European immigrants, especially immigrants from Poland, from Russia, and others who had come to the Connecticut Valley in the 19th century, the 1880s, 1890s, and early 1900s. George Sheldon and the colonial rival people thought that such people weren't real Americans in a certain sense. They didn't have, they weren't due the same respect or the sense of place that the old colonial people had, who descended from the people who'd come to Massachusetts in the 1600s and 1700s. They were viewed in a way as alien intruders, which was part of the colonial revival movement, because that was really a movement against the modernization and urbanization of American life. People like George Sheldon and the people who celebrated their colonial ancestors thought that America had strayed from the Jeffersonian perspective of a nation of tradesmen and of farmers. And they feared industrialization and all the ills that that brought to America, so they thought. And so that's a very important aspect of it, too. The idea that the people who don't belong here can be erased from history by not telling their stories.
And
George
Sheldon. As you think about all of that perspective, how do you hope your book complicates or deepens our understanding of this historical event?
Well, the first thing I hope it does is bring attention to it. This has been such a forgotten story compared to the later stories of the American Revolution and victory over England. I really wanted to convey the idea that early American history is so complicated, so interesting, and so important. The values that John Williams thought he was promulgating are part of American life and American history today. The idea of the patriotism, loyalty to cause and country, loyalty to faith and family. It's really a great story, a religious story of the faith of the people of Deerfield. It's so many stories in one. It's the competition over control of the North American continent, the hostility between France and England, the hostility between various Indian tribes, many of whom battled each other. People forget that there were over 500 tribes and bands in America, and just because they were natives didn't mean they were all allied for the same cause. Mm. And so many of them fought against each other. And so,
pause there, James. It's so much to unpack, and it's a important story that you're telling. James L. Swanson is author of The Deerfield Massacre, A Surprise Attack, A Forced March, and The Fight for Survival in Early America. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
In honor of Pi Day, Let's go out on a song produced by the folks behind the webcomic called YTMND. But first, let me just tell you what's happening tomorrow. The NAACP Image Awards are celebrating the outstanding performances in television and film and music by people of color. And they're happening this weekend. We'll talk about it tomorrow. See you then.
3.14159265358979323846262.
Having a team feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 422 through 428. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley, in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.